The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and made possible thanks to our sponsor, Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Visit resethastudy.com to learn more about their work.
Quote, "I wanted you to see what real courage is instead of getting the idea that courage is a man with a gun in his hand. It's when you know you're licked before you begin. But you begin anyway and see it through, no matter what." Sound familiar? Well, it just might be. It's a quote from Harper Lee's 1960 book, To Kill a Mockingbird. Here we see Atticus Finch, a fictional lawyer and father whose goal is to raise his children to judge people without prejudice, explaining that pain and morphine addiction have plagued the life of the elderly neighbor, Mrs. DeBose. To Kill a Mockingbird holds its place as a classic in modern American literature. It captures a specific time in history, but many of its overarching themes remain relevant today. Pain has been around since the beginning of time. It shows up in literature, movies, history books, philosophical teachings, pretty much everywhere. There's no question of its existence. We feel it, and it's there. But why we feel pain and its overall purpose and meaning haven't been so straightforward. Throughout history, people have endured pain for many reasons, and as treatments evolved, so did people's attitudes towards pain. As we look back on the history of pain management within the U.S., we see that no one therapy, drug, or treatment has worked for everyone. But the pursuit for better pain management still remains today. So as we continue the pursuit for better pain management, we must go back to the past and learn in order to move forward. Hi, I'm Mel Forrest, and you're listening to The Pain Pod.
When I started becoming interested in pain 30 years ago, it was not something in my own experience.
It may feel weird to say that you're interested in pain, but many of us are, myself included. Back in 2012, the Journal of Pain reported that the annual cost of chronic pain was as high as $635 billion a year. So yeah, I think it's safe to say that people are interested in pain, or more specifically, pain management. But how did this interest manifest? When did the search for better pain management take off in the U.S., and how did it evolve? In this episode, we explore just that by diving into the history of pain management within the United States.
My name is Marcia Meldrum. I was an associate researcher professor in the Center for Social Medicine at the Semmel Institute.
The Semmel Institute is a research institute of the University of California here in Los Angeles.
But more recently, I've developed arthritis. And so now I understand what people say when they talk about chronic pain. It is kind of insidious.
Insidious. Something that presents itself gradually over time and often has harmful effects. Some synonyms for insidious include sinister, pernicious, and wicked. I don't know about you, but for me, these words evoke deeply unpleasant feelings. But they also have roots in spirituality and religion. So to better understand people's perception of chronic pain, maybe we should go back to these roots.
Pain has always had a deeply religious meaning. In fact, in some ways, you could say that pain is one of the problems that religion has addressed in the long, long years before modern medicine developed. There is not a major religion that doesn't address pain in some way, usually by asserting that you rise above pain by essentially abandoning the concerns of the body for those of the soul. Pain is very central to Judeo-Christian thought. You think of the book of Job, you think of the story of Christ. I mean, it's central. We suffer pain. If we are sinful, we suffer pain because God wishes us to learn from the pain. So pain always had a lot of philosophical meaning. And for, as I say, the number of years before modern medicine was introduced, there was always a certain element within culture that if you had pain, you were to some degree expected to suffer through it. That it was part of life, it was part of the payment for original sin, if you want to put it that way. And it was something to be endured.
When there is purpose or meaning behind pain, it can help a person reconcile, grasp, or come to terms with it. But it's at this point in history that we begin to see a shift in the meaning and purpose behind pain.
This begins to change in the 19th century, and quite rapidly. You see this happening actually relatively rapidly, particularly for acute pain. Also, many people begin to adopt a more existential point of view, a less religious point of view. They begin to think that life is to be lived, and therefore that pain, among other things, is one of the things that we should try to get rid of, abandon, or deal with in some fashion.
Today, we might get a text from a friend that says, "I'm having an existential crisis!" To this, we might respond with a cute cat meme, offer our support, and be on our way. But in the late 19th to early 20th century, after years of war and loss of faith, people were looking for meaning and value in human existence.
So this perspective changes quite remarkably in the early years of the 20th century. And so that people with chronic pain are not only in pain, but they see no meaning in the pain in most cases. And if you don't have an explanation for the pain, you feel depressed. And no matter how people treat you, you feel to some degree stigmatized because you are not able to do the things that they're kind of expecting you to do.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb inside of his skin and walk around in it. Atticus Finch, and you guessed it, To Kill a Mockingbird.
So in those circumstances, what people want is they want an explanation for why they have pain. They want to know how they can get rid of it. And I think for most 20th century individuals, certainly in America and Europe, pain, it's something to be gotten rid of, something to be eliminated from your life.
Let go of the things that no longer serve you. As the meaning and purpose behind enduring pain dwindled, the desire to let go or rid oneself of pain became a driving force at the time, leading to rapid advancements in pain relief within the U.S. It's important to note that before the 20th century, many people were expected to endure pain, to a certain extent. But this does not mean that physicians didn't try to treat pain. Marsha elaborates on pain relief options that were available before the 20th century.
As you might guess, drugs have been the mainstay for pain treatment for a long, long time, and especially opium and alcohol. That's what doctors had to relieve pain, was opium and alcohol. At different times, different physicians used them in a greater or less degree. They might be used, for example, when a surgeon was going to do some operation. They only did minor operations in those days, but setting a broken leg or removing an external growth, the patient might be given alcohol or opium to deal with the pain. From the 1600s on, laudanum, which is essentially opium dissolved in alcohol, became a drug which people took for pain. And some people actually began to take it very frequently. They began to take it almost every day. And through the 19th century, you see quite a number of people developing what we would consider to be addiction. And more often, the individual was considered to be an invalid. You know, they stayed in bed most of the time. They took medicine. They were not well. But they were usually treated with, you know, care and consideration because of their, you know, debilitating illness. And this persisted throughout the 19th century. However, two things happened in the 19th century. The first thing was the introduction of surgical anesthesia. The other thing that happened was the Civil War.
We hear more about the influence and evolution of pain management in the U.S. after this brief word from our sponsor.
The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and made possible thanks to our sponsor, Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Visit resethastudy.com to learn more about their work.
try to do something every day. And even if it is just a walk, I live in an urban area, just walking to the grocery store or something like that can lift your spirits up.
This is Cindy Springer. She's the director of clinical operations for Tremo. Not every day is the same, and Cindy shares a few things that help her get through the painful ones.
Occasionally, I will take some sort of analgesic, but I found that, you know, keep moving. A lot of times it can be counterintuitive, but as long as the pain isn't sharp pain when you do a certain activity, going to Pilates or doing some walking or something just to keep moving.
Chronic pain can change a person's life, from relationships to daily routines. Cindy reflects on ways she's navigated significant life changes.
I think it's just acknowledging it, you know, if you need to talk to somebody or go to therapy or something like that to help talk out, you know, what the problem is and how you're going to get through it. I think that helps.
It's safe to say that the last 2 years have affected and changed the lives of everyone, including Cindy. She shares some simple joys that kept her moving forward.
I moved to my current place in the city 2 weeks before everything closed down. So I did a lot of walking, you know, because gyms were closed. And so it was fun to learn the city that I had only driven in. So, you know, you see a much different view when you walk. So that helped. I watched way too much TV. I did a couple of 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzles. There were days when I thought, oh, I just... that piece is not here. They must have left it out.
Sometimes that one piece really feels like it's not there, but somehow it all comes together and things keep moving. As the world begins to reopen, I asked Cindy, what excites and keeps you moving forward these days?
I think the main thing is travel. I really like to travel, so I've already got some trips planned both for work and for pleasure, so... that's probably the most thing that I'm looking forward to.
Hi, my name is Patrick. As someone living with hemophilia and arthritis in my joints, I know firsthand how difficult and debilitating chronic pain can be. I also know the challenges that come with trying to find relief, which is why I'm excited to share with you the Reset HA study from Tremo. Tremo is founded with the goal of developing and delivering non-opioid pain therapies for people living with pain. Tremo's Reset HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia. The study's evaluating an oral, non-opioid investigational drug designed to be taken once a day to see if it may potentially help relieve joint pain and improve physical function in people with hemophilic arthropathy. You may be eligible to participate in this clinical research study if you are between the ages of 12 and 75, have been diagnosed with hemophilia A or B, have chronic pain in one or more joints, and do not take opioid medication more than 4 days a week. If you are interested in learning more about taking part in Tremo's Reset HA study, visit resethastudy.com. That's resethastudy.com. to find a study location near you. Reset the way you manage your pain. Visit resethastudy.com today.
Pain was really at that point divorced then from medicine for the first time in a really concrete way.
We continue our discussion about the history of pain management within the U.S. with Marcia Meldrum, retired associate researcher professor at the Semmel Institute. While we see a shift in attitudes towards the meaning and purpose of pain, treatment to address it begins to advance. Marcia talks about the evolution of surgical anesthesia and its subsequent influence on mainstream pain relief.
Two things happened in the 19th century. The first thing was the introduction of surgical anesthesia. We have a really firm date for that, 1846. This changed the perspective of physicians to a great degree. For the first time, they were able to operate on patients without causing them pain. Previously, causing patients pain was often a regular part of treatment. But all of a sudden, you could not just set their legs, you could open them up and take things out, and the patient would, you know, sleep through it. And this was revelatory to surgeons. Very, very quickly, anesthesia became the standard for surgical operations. there was some hesitancy among patients and other physicians initially. I mean, think about what you're doing here. You're essentially rendering someone unconscious, and then you're doing whatever you want with them. Philosophically, you're taking away their free will. But it was such a boon to be able to be relieved of pain when you had to have an operation that very quickly it became a standard, not only in surgery, but also in childbirth.
Let's go back for a moment. Up until this point in history, people were expected to endure pain. Religious and spiritual meaning was attributed to pain, which in a way became its own form of pain relief. But to tolerate pain for so long made some lose faith and begin to question the meaning of life. And this new relief from pain seemed to present a better quality of life.
So pain was really at that point divorced then from medicine for the first time in a really concrete way. The other thing that happened was the Civil War.
The Civil War began in 1861 and ended in 1865, but its effects and influence lasted well beyond.
Many soldiers experienced severe wounds, amputations, nerve injuries during the war, and lived afterwards, and were often then using morphine or laudanum to relieve the pain, which they were in really for the rest of their lives. Many of them developed what was essentially addiction. And it was the concern of people about that particular type of addiction. Certainly they were not the only addicts in the world, but it was the concern about the brave, sturdy soldiers that sort of led to doctors becoming worried about the use of any opiate on a regular basis.
At this point, the desire to get rid of pain was the ultimate goal. But as treatments and drugs rapidly advanced in the hopes of curing pain, many new obstacles and issues presented themselves.
In the 1890s, Bayer introduced two drugs. The first of these was a diacetylated form of morphine, which is heroin. It was about 10 years. Heroin was marketed as being a pain reliever, which was as effective as morphine, but was not addictive. It was quickly discovered that this was not, in fact, the case. A great many people became addicted to heroin. And also, I mean, it certainly wasn't the first street drug. Opium itself had been on the streets for years. But heroin became a street drug rather quickly. And a number of sort of lower people of what were considered lower immigrant classes began to use heroin and created a distinct panic about the consequences of the spread of this drug use. So heroin became, up until the present day, the most stigmatized form of morphine in the United States.
Mrs. DeBose was a morphine addict. She took it as a painkiller for years. She said she was going to leave this world beholden to nothing and nobody. Jim, when you're as sick as she was, it's all right to take anything to make it easier. But it wasn't all right for her. Like the fictional character Mrs. DeBose, the hope of curing pain plagued many with addiction problems that continue throughout history. However, it's also important to note that during this time, other significant advancements were beginning to lay the groundwork for pain relief that we still see and use today.
Bayer had also, in 1898, introduced aspirin. Now, aspirin had been known before, not aspirin, but salicylic acid, which is the basic compound. It was effective for headaches, for example, but it usually disturbed the stomach as well. But when salicylic acid was acetylated, acetylsalicylic acid, which is aspirin, you could take it fairly safely and without any stomach distress. And we do have records of people who had suffered with, for instance, arthritis or headaches for years, discovering aspirin. This was 1898. It really changed people's perspective towards pain. Many people who had suffered from pain did not have to suffer anymore. And it's laid the ground for the development of the analgesia industry. So that's the story in a nutshell.
When a person attributes meaning to pain, it can shape their perception and experience of it. But when that meaning is taken away, that perspective shifts. People wanted and needed better pain management in order to live a life worth living. And we begin to see this with the advent of aspirin. He was really nice. Most people are, Scout, when you finally see them. Throughout the season, we will continue our journey through history, uncovering significant moments and events that have shaped the evolution of pain management within the U.S. and better understand how we keep moving forward with pain.
Know your medical history. Know your medications. Know what works for you. And then finally, learn the art of negotiation.
We discuss when and how to seek treatment for chronic pain next time on episode 2 of The Pain Pod. The Pain Pod is written and hosted by me, Mel Forrest, produced by Keith Corneluk, edited by Jose Miguel Baez, artwork by Ryan Gielen and Christina Newhard, post-production support from Joshua Sterling Bragg, Rob Bradford, Allison Stoney, and Avra Friedman, and executive produced by Patrick James Lynch. The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and presented by Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Tremo's Reset HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia. And you can learn more about it by visiting resethastudy.com. And as always, if you like this episode, make sure to subscribe, rate, and share The Pain Pod. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mel Forrest, and we'll be back next time with episode 2 of The Pain Pod.